Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Felt very sweet to just sit here in the quiet for a while tonight. For talking, I'd like to follow up on some musings that I brought in last Monday, but I don't think it'll matter if you weren't here last Monday. Thanks for moving in closer, because I don't think my voice is all that strong tonight. Last week I started from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s talk, or part of a talk, in which he talks about being maladjusted. And he says, I never intend to adjust myself to discrimination, to religious bigotry, to an economy of greed, I'm paraphrasing there, to the madness of militarism. And we could add to that list pretty easily. We know that Dr. King himself devoted his life to nonviolent response, to not adjusting himself to these evils, and at the same time not allowing himself to create enemies, to harden around the pain of what he witnessed. And this continues to be a live, important question for us right now. How do we stay alive to each other, open-hearted and joyful, and able to dare to respond when we don't know how? When our hearts are broken and when we feel maladjusted. I think we know the feeling of that. It's like, what am I doing in this particular world? What is it doing in me? So what is it to be creatively maladjusted? By which I don't want to just offer another definition, because that's not where we're going with this. So we talked some about that as a statement of practice, and we connected it with the Buddha's response to a question asked by Subhuti in the Diamond Sutra. So I want to explore this some more tonight as we continue to be engaged in a practice period, whatever that is. I'm discovering that for me at the moment, the practice period seems to just be a time of wondering and experimenting. So this evening may have a bit of that quality of, field notes from a practice period. Coming back to Subhuti's question. Subhuti has just watched the Buddha making his begging rounds, very simply doing what he does as a monk. And Subhuti has very clearly been deeply moved by this wordless teaching of just putting on the robe, picking up the bowl, abiding nowhere, bring forth this mind, is a koan I've been bringing in because it feels so central to what practice is, I think. And what am I practicing? So while putting on his robe, while picking up his bowl, offering the empty bowl to those who've been cooking their noon meal, receiving food, eating, cleaning his bowl, taking off his robe, putting away his bowl, arranging his seat, sitting down, addressing his attention to those in front of him. And I noticed that as I have been reading and rereading that passage, that kind of a recitation of the doing of a day, a feeling of ease in his not making a bunch of decisions about it. What robe am I going to wear today? Which bowl should I take? Which houses am I going to go to? Are they going to have good food, or who makes the best stew? And how much are they going to give me? And blah, 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 blah. You don't get a feel for any blah, 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 blah in there, although it could be there, right? But there's a sense of not living in that, of surrendering to the discipline of, now I put on this robe, now I pick up this bowl, now I go to this door, now I go to this door, now I'm coming back. And so that abiding, the feeling of abiding nowhere, not inhabiting the world of constantly having to make choices, in a way, I won't take up residence here. A choice, in a way, can you see how a choice can feel like taking up residence? Like finding, this is my choice, right? This is my solid ground. But it's fake, right? There is no solid ground. It doesn't hold up. And so there is a kind of light-footedness, I think, or ease in that sense of not having to take a position in just doing the what you do. And just like, now I'm having breakfast, now I'm brushing my teeth. And so Subhuti, clearly in the sutra, you can feel sort of between the lines, is moved by this, feels that there's something there, you know, feels that there's something powerful and lovely there. And asks and sort of wonders, well, how do you do that, right? It's not how my life always feels, right? Because I am wondering which robe I'm putting on and which bowl I'm picking up, and etc. So he's got a kind of has and has not mentality going on a little bit here, I think. And we do often when we go looking for help, when we go looking for teaching. How do you do that? And there's nothing wrong with that either, right? I'm not saying there's a wrongness to that, but it's just the feeling of it. If we want to walk this path, this large path of the bodhisattva who dedicates her or his being, whatever that is, to what? Yeah? To awakening. And what's that? I think Subhuti isn't even necessarily formulating all that. It's just, look at this. How do I do that? Right? Because he asked, how do we get our body, speech, and mind under control if we wish to be making this offering of ourselves? So that's a way of asking, what is practice, right? He's asking specifically, how should we walk? How should we How should we stand? How should we walk? How should we control our minds? And it's a kind of a... and what I noticed in that was, you know, it's not a foreign question to us, you know, pulled as we are this way and that by the daily news and the screens we use and the multitude of calls on our time and attention. A dozen gurus a day are happy to tell us how to eliminate the negative and accentuate the positive. And they have lots of helpful advice how to exercise our demons. But the Buddha's advice doesn't go in that direction. So Buddha's asking, yeah, if someone sets forth on the Bodhisattva path, how should they stand? How should they walk? How should they control their thoughts? And the Buddha says, however many being, or those who would now set forth on the Bodhisattva path should thus give birth to this thought. So if I have the image of sort of standing ready to take a step, set forth on this path, whatever that means. Well, I am going to set forth any moment, right? Every moment I'm setting forth. That's what a moment is. And to give birth to this thought seems like such a generous... It's not a how do I control, right? Give birth to this thought. Let it happen. It's already there. Let it happen. This thought, however many beings there are, in whatever realms of being might exist, whether they're born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have perception or no perception, or neither perception nor no perception, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. And he goes on to explain that we do this also being aware that there is no one to do the saving and no saving is done. And that this one thing that's not a thing, that will bring benefit that is beyond immeasurable. And I was thinking, in a way, feeling the dreamlike quality of this. It's sort of like winking, blinking, and nod one night, you know, set out in a solar ship. And to me, there's something important about that kind of dreamlike quality of it, which is a kind of trust, a kind of innocence in this vow. Yeah, a kind of, and in the sutra, the word belief is used, at least in the translation that we're using, and. So in a way there's a kind of, yeah, a kind of innocence, and it feels like a kind of humbling myself to the largeness of everything. It's like, I don't know where the beings are. I don't know who they are. I don't know what they're like. I don't know what they think. You know, I don't know what a life is like for them. Past, present, future, whatever realm. there are so many beings we don't can't even imagine, right? So if I let myself enter with my whole heart into that not knowingness, right? That which I can kind of imagine but can't grab any hold of, and I let my vow take me there, then to me there's a complete renunciation of control. I cannot be vowing to accomplish something because I have no idea what I would be accomplishing. I don't know who these beings are and what it would be to save them, right? And how would I know if I saved them when I don't even know if they exist or not? So there's this kind of wonderful surrender to the absurdity of the vow. And yet, the Buddha says, this is where the power is. This is where the power is. If I give myself to this, if I give birth to it, if I let it, because it's already, you can't give birth to something that's not already in you. So if I just give birth to that thought and then unweave it, right? Immediately take the language off of it. Then what is it, right? So I have to strip the language of meaning in a way to find out what a vow really is. So if I think the vow is carried by the meaning of the words, well, I'm already sunk here, right? Because he already just erased the words for me. It's like he wrote something on the board and then immediately, you know, wipes it off again. And so there's a kind of alchemy going on here in our hearts. It's like we're using the vehicle of the words, of the vow, and then abandoning that right away. So there's that language in Buddhism all the time, right? To take the raft across the river and then drop the raft. But what if this very thing he's telling us to do is like that already? Right? Because, and there's that wonderful cartoon, I bet others of you saw it too, where somebody's standing on the one side of the river and somebody's standing on the other side of the river, and the one is calling to the other, how can I get to the other side? And the other one's calling, you are on the other side. it's kind of has that quality. So nothing is accomplished. So it's not about accomplishing anything because we're acknowledging that nothing is accomplished. So we have sometimes talked about non-doing, you know, the action of non-doing. Can you feel how this vow has the quality of non-doing, of an offering that will be in whatever you do? It's the non-doing of whatever you do. So I want to stop for a moment because it just is such a radical move. And I want to stop to restate the question. How, Suguti's question, I think, is, if it's my question, which what other Suguti is around here, how can I be a transformative presence in this world? Right? It's kind of the question we're up against, right? Where this world is in trouble, we're in trouble here, and beauty. Even to say we're in trouble already is the story that has to be unwoven, right? And yet, so how do we hold that belief lightly also, provisionally, and act from it? So then we have the question, how can I be a transformative presence in this world? And Subhuti asking, how should I get myself to be? Right? How should we stand and walk and control our minds? Right? So in a way it's like a question of what mold should I put myself into to reshape myself in your image, right? We're so tempted to fall for that, right? Give me the mold and I'll just like cram myself into it and hope to be you. Like that, right? How should I remake myself? How can I not be as I am, but be some other way? That's the kind of hidden barb in that question, I think. Yeah? How can I not be me? It's sad. It's a sad and hard question coming out of some real feelings that we have, I think. And he responds with, give birth to this thought, which is already undoing that distress, isn't it? If you can give birth to this thought, you are already the mother of this thought, right? You are already the womb of this thought. It's not that there's nothing wrong with you. So first of all, acknowledge that you are what will give birth to this thought. Nobody else is here to do it. And at the same time, so he says, give birth to this thought, and at the same time, release every element of the thought so that it becomes unplaceable. Inhabit this form which is no form. Abiding nowhere, bring forth this heart mind. And then don't get stuck on your nowhere either, because you need to bring it forth right here. Right? Right where you are. In this place. So do it. And then he goes on later in the sutra to say something kind of interesting. And, you know, sometimes we feel like, well, at the moment, I haven't got it, you know? I can't do it. So he says, that's okay. If you can't do it, learn it. If you can't do it, learn it. Study it. Practice it. Yeah? Mess with it. Do what you do. And in either case, he says, go ahead and teach it. That's a weird thing to say, right? Whether you can do it or only can learn it, go ahead and offer it. Don't wait. You know, don't fall into that trap of, when I'm a perfected being, then I'll have something to offer. Right? And that requires fearlessness, because we're going to make mistakes, right? And we may offer something and then watch somebody go and get hurt or hurt somebody. Or watch ourselves get hurt or hurt somebody. It takes a real fearlessness of determination to go ahead and say it. Go ahead and offer it. Yeah? Go ahead and share what we've got, even when it feels a little shaky. Yeah? Don't worry about the results. He says, because I can assure you that this is what lights everything up. Not your perfect. This is that forget your perfect offering, right? This offering itself is what lights everything up. And then again, there's no lighting, right? But all this stuff about merit that comes up in this sutra, I take as that which lights everything up. This, your offering, is that which lights everything up. So if it has so much power, then what are we to do with it? And how do we do it? What do we practice? How do we teach it? What does any of that mean? So, two things about that. So far, if I'm remembering what might be want to be held of this, we're saying we don't have to try to make ourselves be what we're not. we are beings with soft bodies and soft hearts. We're not really moldable, as if that would be desirable anyway. And we have within us something that we can bring forth that will light up the world, that does light up the world. And all that it is our willingness to offer it. And we can't even define it. And so, but then if we here are trying to practice a way, what does that have to do with this? What are we trying to practice? And how do we, and what's the trying and the not trying of it? What are we doing here? And so I love the clue that Prajnatara gives us when she says, I'm a poor person of the way. This is what I do, she's saying. When I breathe in, I don't live in the world my mind makes. And when I breathe out, I don't get caught up in the world of cause and effect. That's the wheel of the sutras I'm always turning. And so, you know, in the tradition, that's what you offer if you're a monk or a nun, right? You turn the wheel reciting the sutras, and that's the teaching. And that's the offering, and that's the prayer. Yeah? So that's the wheel I'm always turning. 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 scrolls. So a very portable practice, yeah? You can do it anytime and anywhere. Very practical. But again, how? How? You know, we're like, oh, okay, great, sounds great, but... but I have no clue how I would do that, right? That's a question to hold, right? What if we, just as the Buddha said with the just give birth to this thought, what if we don't worry about how and we just see what it's like to do it? Yeah? Some night, there's no reason we can't take that step. You got very little to lose, right? Sitting here in our personal and impersonal worlds, which will go on rolling. Maybe everything to lose. When I breathe in, I don't live in the world my mind makes. I find that so beautiful because there's the acknowledgement, there's no blame about making that world, right? It's a simple acknowledgement. When I breathe in, already I'm busy making a world. Yeah? When I breathe in, already there's that. But I don't have to live in it. And to me, that comes right back to that dreamlike quality of the vow, right? Wherever, whatever beings there are, in whatever shape, and whatever place, you know, there's this kind of almost sort of a wave a wand and it appears quality to it. And it's that way here too, right? When I breathe in, I don't live in the world my mind makes. And when I breathe out, I don't get caught up in the world of cause and effect. That's the wheel I'm always turning. So I think the invitation, you know, here is to feel it in a visceral way. Maybe that's one way anyway. And Byron Katie has a similar suggestion. She says the only thing you need to remember is this: if a thought hurts, question it. That's an interesting formulation, isn't it? If a thought hurts, question it. And another way that you could say that is, you know, if you feel it clutching you, that thought, if you feel it tightening everything up and shrinking you, just be curious about it. And she has a whole system, yeah, which she calls the work, for questioning your thoughts. And it's quite helpful, but it's also a system. It's not the only, it's a tool, yeah. So what's the simplest deal? What if you look at it this way? Since I am inseparable from everything, since we are all woven in this same fabric of a moment that's indivisible, yeah, then naturally it makes sense to take care of us. And what is that? Well, quite a lot is known about it, actually, about taking care of us. At least humans, we need food, clothing, sunlight, shelter, love, sleep, exercise, toothbrushes, beauty, and a way to contribute, a way to serve. You know, it's not that long a list. And we know the gift of our ancestors is this knowledge that meditation has power. And might even be essential in the long run. And it may be one of those requirements of life, actually. And we give it a name and we give it a form and we argue about the kinds, but maybe it's just something that beings do. Anyway. And so the doing is not all that complicated. But what the Buddha says here, I think, is it's about how we do these things. If we do them with the awareness, if we practice doing them with the awareness that we walk on the empty sky all together as one fabric, and that our very being is offering, that it's really what it is to be alive, this offering. If we allow that one non-thought to be at the very center and keep returning to it doggedly, then each and everything that we do is this one practice of remembering who we are. And in that, we are free. And everything else lacks the power to impede us. So I'd like to, rather than me talk about this link, I'd like to leave you with a suggestion that it can be fun to, I'm having fun connecting this one move, this one vow, with our four boundless vows, and looking at how are our four boundless vows that we, the one thing that we recite pretty much every time we meet, how are those the sort of phrases of a sentence? How are those the expression of taking care of ourselves? There is time for a little bit of discussion.